Well, imagine being down here in New York. It's almost like being in the tropics for you.
Ah, you know, we left warm weather in Toronto and came down here and found snow on the ground and winds rushing up and down Fifth Avenue. It was, we felt we'd come to winter.
What's going on here? I think
I don't know.
Last week it was in the high 60s here.
I know. Well, people say it's the greenhouse factor, but I don't know what it is.
I think I was reading in the Times that there is no such thing as the greenhouse effect.
Well, I'm glad to know it. I don't like the sound of it.
The last time I saw you, we didn't actually meet. It was in 1984, and it was at the Penn International Congress.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And you gave a stirring speech.
Well, I got my fingers wrapped very sharply by Norman Mailer about that.
No.
Oh, yes, indeed. Norman was cross, and he made a statement which ran across Canada that it was astonishing that anybody as pompous as I was should be a good writer.
I took that from Mailer?
I took that rather as a compliment because I don't want to be like Norman Mailer.
Well, Norman has been known to be somewhat pompous in his life.
Oh, my God. You should. Well, you saw him at that conference. Sitting on the women and choking people off and pushing everybody to right and left and pushing Mr. Schultz forward. And, oh, it was grisly.
It was his show, all right.
It was his show, but he made an awful mess of it.
Well, it was a wonderful experience. All of those world-class writers together in those two hotels.
Yes.
I had never been to anything like that before.
Well, it was a difficult affair because the women were after Norman, understandably, because he was so very rude and disagreeable to them. And they kept asking why there weren't more women on his panels. And he kept saying because he'd invited a list this long and none of them would come. And, you know, it was just one of those impossible situations.
Yeah. Well, your speech, I don't remember all the details now, but your speech was a wonderful one. And matter of fact, I made a complete little broadcast, BookBeat broadcast, out of your speech alone.
Well, I was urging the writers to go home and write and stop trying to get into politics change the world. Yeah. They can only change it through their writing.
That's right. I believe you really, I remember now, you really set the, I think you set the Congress straight. You said, stop all this bickering, in effect, and stop all this bickering, go back and start to write.
Back to your ivory towers. Well, you see, they kept wanting to send telegrams to South Africa saying, you stop what you're doing or you better watch Penn, New York is going to be very angry with you. Silly, foolish stuff. There was such a lot of bubbleheads, I couldn't believe it.
Well, they had a lot of petitions floating around, didn't
they? Oh, endless petitions, yes. And the people who were really interested in writing just got swamped. And people like Gunter Grass and so forth were absolutely puzzled by the nonsense that was going on. And the man from France sneered into his upper lip almost went right up his nose. It was fantastic. It was a bad show.
There were some very good conferences. There are seminars.
Oh, the seminars are okay, yes.
There was one on poetry that I liked very much. But these were political, and they weren't really covered.
It was the general meetings that were so aggressive and full of confrontation and people shouting, pig, 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 and that sort of nonsense.
But you're glad you went, though, aren't you?
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it for the world. It was an astonishing example of what happens when you get a lot of people who are artists or ought to be artists thinking they're politicians. And you see, the affair was so heavily weighted on the side of people who had written one four-line poem from Arkansas, who were there and had a lot to say, and the writers, the real writers, were more or less swamped.
But I believe it's probably accurate to say that a writer's judgment, political judgment, is no better or worse than the public at large.
No, it is not good and is likely to be bad because it is subjective and probably not very much based on close analytical observation of the political scene. They're not built that way. Yeah. I'm interested in politics because for 20 years I was a newspaper man. But I know how easy it is to get caught up in some ridiculous explosion of anger about a thing you don't really understand at all.
I think writers are best when they, whether they succeed or fail, is another discussion, but I think writers are best when they try to look at the soul.
Oh, well, of course, yes. That's exactly what they're supposed to do, but not all of them have caught on to that.
No. Well, let's talk about you and your work. Where in Canada were you born?
I was born in a small village of 500 people called Thamesville in Western Ontario. But I only lived there till I was about 5 years old, and my parents moved to another place in extreme eastern Ontario, north of Ottawa. Very cold, bitter, harsh place it was. And then after 5 years there, they moved to a very charming old city, a sort of Empire loyalist city called Kingston, which is at the confluence of the St. Lawrence River and Lake Ontario. Most charming place. And I lived there for the great part of my youth. I went to the university there because there was a very good university in the city called Queen's University. Very Scottish place. And so that was where I grew up. And I went to boarding school in Toronto for quite a while.
You also studied overseas, didn't you?
Yes, I went to Oxford after I'd been at Queen's. Because, you see, it was impossible for me to take a degree at Queen's University because entrance to the university demanded proficiency in two mathematical subjects, and I never could do mathematics at all. I persistently got zeros on mathematical examinations. I had no comprehension of it. And I know now why, but at that time I didn't know why, and it was very humiliating. So my parents thought, well, we'd better send him to some place that isn't as pernickety as Queen's, so they sent me to Oxford.
Thank God they have calculators today. I mean, I had trouble, too. It was an awful experience. My father would box my ears when I couldn't add and subtract, and he was trying to help me with my homework. And I think I must have had a mental block.
Well, my father gave me a piece of deeply immoral advice when I had failed my matriculation in maths twice. He said, you know, you really mustn't bother too much about this, because you'll always find that there are people who would do it for you for pay, and they're generally honest because they work, you know, this way, and they hate dishonesty.
Your parents were journalists.
My parents were, yes. My father and my mother and both my brothers and the generation before that, there had been some journalistic writers.
Did they have their own paper?
Well, my father had newspapers and radio stations and things. The earlier people wrote for other publications. You know, they were columnists and that sort of thing.
So you were born into an important family.
I was born in a family where everybody wrote. And I grew up with the idea that everybody did write because it seemed to be the thing that everybody I knew did. I think I was 12 years old before I realized that not everybody wrote or found writing easy.
Well, that writing is not easy.
No, it isn't easy, but if you grow up to do it in a journalistic family, you know that there are certain things you have to do. You have to say right off what you're going to write about and then explain it and not mess around for two or three paragraphs before you back into your subject, which is what amateurs so often do when they're faced with journalistic work.
There's a great deal of difference between the journalistic work and the creative work, though, isn't there?
Well, actually, I don't know that there is. I never thought so, because often young people who were starting in the newspaper world would come to me and say, how can I develop a good journalistic style? And I would say, there's only one style, you know, and it's the best writing you can do. And if you imagine that anything less than your best is good enough for a newspaper, you shouldn't have a job on a newspaper. Only the very best writing you can do is any good for the job that you have in hand. And if it's a journalistic job, get down to it and tell your story and give your background material and just get on with it.
I don't understand that phrase, journalistic style, because you can read from paper to paper or listen to radio station to radio station, and all the writing seems to be the same.
I know. There used to be a generation of managing editors who imposed a kind of gee whiz style on some of the reporters, but it was bad teaching. I always discouraged it as much as possible.
Did you work for your father when you left Oxford?
No, I never worked for my father directly. I edited a newspaper that he owned, but he never interfered. I used to call him sometimes and ask him for advice about things, but he never directly gave any advice or direction. I was the person who did it. So there it was. He was himself a very good writer on political subjects. He was a good political journalist.
What was the paper you edited?
It was called the Peterborough Examiner, and it appeared in a district of eastern Ontario, covered quite a wide area between Toronto and Kingston.
Is that paper still in your family?
No. It sold some years ago.
And how long did you work there?
20 years.
Some of these terrific columns, the Marchbanks columns, must have been a product of your newspaper work.
Oh, yes. I wrote those for the Peterborough Examiner, and then they rather took on, and other papers wanted them, and eventually quite a few papers, including some in the States, were publishing the thing weekly. But, you know, a weekly column is a heavy thing to carry. And I did it for a long time, and then, eventually, I went on to other work and didn't do it anymore.
Still, I would imagine Marchbanks' life paralleled your own, the difficulties with the furnace, and
it was really imaginary. I'll tell you, I don't approve of those literary or journalistic columnists who just write about their own direct experience and make their wife into a comic character, and their children become amusing sort of demons, and they're just coining their families in, I think, a totally unacceptable way.
They're not using their imagination.
They're not using imagination. They're grasping and grabbing at the obvious.
Well, let's go back. You have written some 35 books, but obviously the first novel was a departure from your journalism. Tell me about that first book and how it came about. What was it called?
Well, you see, I had written a large number of plays, and a lot of them were produced in Canada, but they didn't travel to other countries because they were about Canadian things, and the interest in Canada was not very great. So I decided to write a novel, and I wrote one on a theme which I had originally thought of as a theme for a play. It was called Tempest Tossed. It was about an amateur group in a city very like Kingston doing a production of a Shakespeare play.
That was a departure with a play. Of course, you're dealing almost exclusively with dialogue, and all of a sudden you're faced with having to fill out the rest of the book. Was this difficult?
No, put a lot of dialogue into my novels because I think people like it, and it's a good way of indicating character. And also, because when I was a boy, if I picked up a book and wondered if I would read it or not, I always looked to see if there was lots of dialogue, and if there was, I read it. And if there were too many pages of solid type, I thought, well, I'll put that one aside for later.
I think we're all like that. Well, you must have scored some, if not success, at least you were interested in this new form for you.
Oh, very much, yes.
And so you continued. Now, I'm reading some of the publicity material. People keep asking you, is there a unifying theme with your books? But in a way, that's kind of a presumptuous question, because it seems to me most writers just write a story.
Well, exactly. That is it. You write because you write, and if there's a unifying theme, it comes out of what you write, and it comes out of yourself. But you see, people like academics are possessed with the notion that you've got some scheme that you wish to put forward, or some philosophy you wish to impose on the world, and that you start off with that, and then you hang stories on it, as you might hang clothes on a model. It's not so. That's ridiculous. If there's any life in the work, it is because you write about people and about situations and about things that really interest you, not to exemplify an idea. I used to try to tell that to students when I was teaching in the university, that you mustn't start out with a theory or a philosophy. I saw so many very clever, capable young people who thought that they would write fiction, and so they built up a big lot of rubbish, which they called a philosophy, and then they hung a story on it. The people never came to life. The whole thing was as dead as mutton.
Yeah, there's that old phrase that if you want to send a message, you go to Western Union. But usually, if a writer feels strongly about something, in the course of his narrative and in the development of his characters, that usually will be revealed, don't you think?
Oh, yes, it will, but it will be revealed because it is part of the man and part of the way he tells his story, rather than because he thinks, I'm going to convince them of this, I'm going to get this across. In the 19th century, there were a lot of novels that were written to promote philosophies or ideas or something, and I remember my grandparents were tremendously fond of a novel called Robert Elsmere, which had won a prize for being the best novel to promote the Christian religion. And you know, it's really a very good novel, but it hasn't lived because it's more about Christianity than it's about Robert Elsmere. And that's not good.
That's also said about Clifford Odets. His plays have not traveled well because they were all pro-left plays of the 1930s, and our social climate has changed.
Yes.
And you can look at Odets as a period piece, perhaps.
Yes.
But it doesn't ring true anymore. Sherbert Anderson, Maxwell Anderson, the same way. It doesn't hold today.
Well, it is unfortunate, and possibly it reveals prejudice in my mind when I say so, but so many of those leftist plays are utterly without humor. You get a play like The Golden Boy, for instance, which was splendid in its day, but it's a kind of gripe piece. It's a protest piece, and although there are lots of jokes in it, they are jokes. They are not humor. They're not a humorous perception of life. They're not a rich understanding of the variety of human character. And that shows, you know, if you're perpetually pushing for the left or for the right, though rightist players are very uncommon, that's going to come out strongly, and as the immediate impact of the play dies, it shows even more strongly. You can't do that forever, because the whole notion of what is left changes from generation to generation.
That's an interesting comment you made about there not being very many plays written by people on the right. That's also, it seems to be true with regard to fiction. Most people who write fiction seem to be on the left. Now, I don't mean far left necessarily, but at least straddling the line. And I wonder why that is. A right wing person doesn't seem to, is it because there is a lack of humor on the right?
I think it
well?
Is that, and I also think that an enormous number of writers think of themselves as underdogs, oppressed people, unappreciated people, and so they feel that the left has something to say to them, but they shouldn't test it too far. The great writer of all time, Shakespeare, his notions about the left were very obvious in all his plays, and although he is sympathetic toward misfortune and misunderstood people and so on and so forth, he hasn't got much time for gripers and whiners and so forth.
Well, back to your own work, Viking has organized your work in trilogies, and your new novel apparently is the third of a group of books dealing very much with the same people, the
yes.
Cornish Trilogy, I
believe yes.
They're calling. Tell me how this book developed and how it was preceded by the other books.
Well, you see, the first book in this group was a book called The Rebel Angels, and it was about university life, but the plot hung on the finding of a manuscript which had been considered to be lost. It was a manuscript which still may possibly exist somewhere. It was a, a manuscript written by Rabelais when he was secretary to the Duc de Berry, describing some of the Duke's war adventures. And nobody's found it, and it may have vanished. Anyway, this was about the discovery of that manuscript and what it might mean to a young scholar with a reputation to make. But what was interesting was that the manuscript had been a neglected piece in the collection of a man who was a compulsive collector. He collected everything, pictures, sculptures, manuscripts, books, the whole works. And as I wrote that book, I thought, you know, this fellow, with his passion for accumulating things, is an interesting person, and I might write a book about him. So I wrote the second book, which was called What's Bred in the Bone, and what was bred in the bone of that man, whose name was Francis Cornish, was a desire for acquisition and a passion for art in all its manifestations. And I wrote that, and I carried Francis Cornish's life right through to his death, and even described his death and the various stages by which he progressed from this world into wherever he was going. But as I was doing that, I thought, you know, what happened to the money? I'm interested in money. I think everybody is more or less interested in money. And I thought, what happened to this man's enormous fortune when he had died? And that meant a third book, and that third book is this one, The Lyre of Orpheus. And what happens to the money is that his descendants set up a foundation to encourage the arts which their uncle Francis had loved so much. And it's about their first venture, which is putting on an opera. And so that's how it developed. It all just, one thing sprang out of another.
Right from the beginning, you have a feeling this opera, with all of the money that's being put into it, is not going to be a complete success. The libretto, for example, is lost, at least has to be developed.
Yes.
And it looks like there are a lot of strikes against it. But there are so many plots and subplots in The Lyre of Orpheus. When you started to write this book, it didn't come off the top of your head. Did you have to pretty well organize how you develop this book? Index cards or whatever?
No. I don't do that. What I do is to make a very great number of notes. And sometimes the notes in total equal the length of the finished book, or may even be more than that. And a great many of them are rejected, but they're just ideas and notions and scraps of things which might contribute to the book. Well, I just got on with it, as I do with all my books, knowing where I was going up to about halfway through the book. And then I always find that the end develops itself. It is somehow or other inherent in the beginning, but you can't see it. I mistrust the idea of plotting a book from start to finish and saying it's going to be like this. It's like stretching something on a frame. It ought to be allowed to grow its own way, and the way it wants to grow will be much more interesting than the scheme that you set out beforehand. I have tried making schemes for books from start to finish. They're never any good. By the time the book's got to the middle, it's found its own life, and it goes on and finishes as it should, rather than according to a plan that you think of when you're trying to think up a plot.
When you were teaching, what did you teach?
I taught, I'll tell you in tedious detail, I taught English drama from 1660 to 1920, which is an area which is rather neglected. And I also taught courses on Bernard Shaw and his contemporaries, because his contemporaries tend to be neglected. Everybody thinks Shaw stands absolutely alone. He doesn't. He stands in the midst of a group of very able playwrights. And so that was what I taught. I taught that to graduate students.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have any creative writing workshops or anything like that?
No. I wouldn't do that because, quite frankly, I couldn't teach anybody to write anything. All I can do is encourage people to go away and write their own way. And my mistrust of creative writing courses, which has got me into trouble with a lot of people, is that I think they encourage, inevitably, the students to write like the teacher. Understandably, the teacher is going to like best something that looks as though he might have written it himself in an off day. Something really astonishing and creative is going to perhaps make him bristle a little and think, this fellow thinks he's somebody. I'll show him a thing or two. And so he proceeds to do that. I know this is dangerous talk, but I just don't believe anybody can teach anybody else to write except by teaching them grammar and perhaps a little bit of economy.
Yeah, it would seem to me that a creative writing student studying for his master's, his thesis has to be, let's say, a novel, and he works very hard on this novel. He turns it into his mentor, who hates it. He could be an editor at Viking and looks at it and says, I hate this, you know, throw it out. Start over again, or he doesn't get his degree. I mean, it's only an opinion.
Yes. And it's an art, you see, and art doesn't lend itself to being taught. Painters will tell you this. They can show a young person how to put the stuff on the canvas and mess it around, but they don't really pretend to teach them how to paint. You have to find your own way of painting. And this is the same with teachers of musical composition. The teacher who lays down the law and says it's got to be like this is not a good teacher. Artists must find their own way. They must educate themselves. And I don't want to be bothered with people who are straining and struggling and busting themselves wanting to write and who probably ought to be doing something else more in their line.
Canada has been in the shadow of the United States, being, of course, geographically huge, but a much smaller country. But it seems to me that writers such as yourself and Alice Munro and Margaret Atwood are really making Canada and Mordecai Rickler making Canada a very visible nation in terms of its writing.
Well, I think that this is unquestionably true, and it seems to me that nations tend to find somehow or other, I can't pretend to know how, an art which is one in which they best express their national feeling. And this is very obviously shown in Australia, where it is painting, and Australian painting is terrific. But I think in Canada, it is writing. And writing seems to be our line, because it is a sort of introspective, thoughtful art. And we seem to have some people who know how to do it.
There also seems to be a reverse immigration to Canada in many respects. It seemed to me I would read that Canadians wanted to get out. It was humdrum. It was drab. I have to leave. But it seems to me that Toronto is a flashy city. It's attracted people from all over the world, all sorts of minorities who have gone there for promise and development. Canada seems to me I hate to use the term emerging nation, but it seems to me really coming on its own.
Well, you may hate to use the term, but I will use it. It is an emerging nation, and it is not emerging as you think of an African nation, emerging in finding its economic feet. We've been on our economic feet for over 100 years, but in finding its spirit and its national means of expression, it is certainly an emerging nation, and it is fascinating how many Canadian writers are finding acceptance all over the world in other languages, among other people. I was really knocked off my feet several weeks ago when I got news from my agent that a book of mine was going to come out in Israel. What on earth people in Israel will find in it to interest them, I don't know, but I'm grateful that they want to do it. And I can hardly wait to see my book come out in Hebrew type. And, you know, in Hungary, they seem to like my stuff. And, of course, in the Scandinavian countries. And sometimes you can understand why the Scandinavians are really very like Canadians. But why people in Israel? And I've also had the great compliment of being pirated by some Oriental countries.
Taiwan. Yes. Taiwan pirates.
Yes.
Well, I think that there's a universality about writing. You're talking a lot about the human condition of the characters in The Lyre of Orpheus. They could be in Hungary, assuming Hungary were a free country.
Mm-hmm.
But they could be any place.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that is the thing, you see. They are Canadians, but some Canadians say, oh, they don't seem very Canadian to me. Their idea of Canada is narrow. As you say, a Canadian or a person in a book of mine can be anywhere. And they're human beings. They're not national puppets.
What's happening in Quebec in terms of writing?
Well, there's some very, very active writing and some very good writing going on in Quebec, but they box themselves in very much because they won't associate themselves with Canadian literature in general. They will only interest themselves in what's written in French. One of the things which used to amuse me enormously was that my books sold pretty well in Quebec because they were published in Paris in translation and then imported into Quebec, and they didn't know they were by an English Canadian. That's sick. That's absurd. But there it was, you see. They seem to want to keep themselves separate from us, and we have so much to share with them. They gain some acceptance in certain circles in Paris, but it is a world of its own. You know, we don't really know intimately and from month to month what's going on in Quebec writing.
That French language law has not been good, has it?
The French language law is very, very counterproductive. The law is that everything has to be in French, and that, for instance, signs on the front of shops can be in French only. Well, that's a little bit tyrannous, you know. It's funny, you know, to go around Toronto and you see shop signs in all kinds of languages, including French, to attract the people who read those languages, and we can all make out what they are. And if we see a thing that calls itself a boutique, we know that it's not for that reason, solely for French buyers. But they are very closed in, and as you know, the French are extremely nationalistic, both on the continent and in Quebec. And I think in the course of time they wake up to the fact that this is shutting them off from the rest of the world.
Yeah, a lot of the English-speaking Canadians in Quebec fled. Montreal has slipped to a smaller city status.
Well, unfortunately, that is true. I remember when I was a boy, everybody thought Montreal was the glamorous city where magnificent things happened and where all the girls were beautiful and the food was all good. That's not the case now. And it's sad. I don't glory in it. I don't know of any English Canadian who does, but it has really fallen on bad days.
And I think there are misperceptions about Canada in the United States as well. And a few years ago, some terrorists were active in Canada and had kidnapped some officials or an official. I can't remember the details.
Yes.
One of the demands was that Canada free all political prisoners.
Yes.
So we blithely read the wires and wrote out our stories and said, and one of the demands is that Canada free its political prisoners. And then somebody said, hey, wait a minute. Canada doesn't have any political prisoners.
No.
And so we began to reassess these, we were just using these kidnappers' demands.
Yes.
And we began to reassess how we were phrasing this, because
yes,
Canada is a democracy. I mean, there are
yes,
no political prisoners in the United States either.
Mm.
But the fact that we so eagerly put this on the radio, political prisoners in Canada, I think showed some misunderstanding.
Well, the French in Quebec have tremendous skill in putting forward their point of view, and they can rather hoodoo you about that sort of thing. But it's true, there weren't any political prisoners, and they were deeply resentful that a French Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau, really sat on them very, very hard, and they've never forgiven him. But he did the only possible thing. He said, these people are terrorists, and if they're let loose, we will have anarchy. And he imposed a law upon them which quelled them for a considerable time. It's very unfortunate. You know, extremist groups and people who glory in being minorities go in for this sort of thing, but you know, the plain fact is Quebec will never leave the Canadian Dominion, because they won't give up the advantages that go with it. They're not going to give away their child allowance and their old age pensions and their hospital benefits and this, that, and the other. A few thousand noisy extremists in Quebec City and in Montreal are very interested in this movement. But when you get out of the country among those hard-bitten Norman farmers who don't even put their money in the bank, they're not going to separate from anything which brings advantage with it.
I think the worst drive I ever had in my life was from Quebec to New York in one installment. I'll never do that again.
No, no.
It was 16, 18 hours or something like that. And I remember driving down that monotonous stretch of highway between Quebec and Montreal and dial switching the radio. It's hearing hillbilly music.
Yes.
Hillbilly music in Canada, and that's what you heard.
But, you know, I must tell you a story which probably will amuse you, which is that when the great Freedom for Quebec movement was going on, the premier of Quebec, René Lévesque, came down to New York to see what he could do about raising some money that would possibly float an independent Quebec state. And Mr. Lévesque was so innocent that he thought that he would be appealing to revolutionaries against British tyranny in New York. And when he got himself talking to the New York bankers, he discovered that they were pre-1776 in their financial thinking. They weren't going to put any money into some sort of cockamamie revolution up north. And one of the most amusing things which brought a great deal of joy to the hearts of English-speaking Canadians was that he thought that they were all down here, you know, going to be sort of blue jeans proletarians in the banking business. And when he got down, one of his aides had to hire him a dress suit so he could talk to the bankers. It was a ridiculous misunderstanding.
That's right. It's a three-piece suit world.
Wall
Street. Well, you have been described as Canada's literary ambassador. Do you like that description?
No, I don't, really. I don't want to be an ambassador, and I don't want to be tagged particularly with a nationalist tag. I just want to be a writer.
Well, you are that, and a very good one, and Canada and the world should be very proud of you.
Oh, you're very generous.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.